From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's a solemn day today as 100 United States senators raise their hands and swear that they will serve as an impartial jury in the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, Lev Parnas, the arrested, jailed, and now out on bail Russian associate of the president's lawyer Rudy Giuliani, he's thrown a hand grenade into the middle of all that. Remember how the president and his defenders say Giuliani's activities in Ukraine were sincere efforts to fight corruption there? Well, no, says Parnas. Here he is on MSNBC last night.
It was never about corruption. It was strictly about the Burisma, which included Hunter Biden and Joe Biden.
This hour on Point, impeachment and the still unfolding story in Ukraine. You can join us now that the trial of the president is set to begin in a few days. What do you think of it all? What do you think is going to happen? Should the new documents released by Lev Parnas become evidence in the trial? Do you even believe him? Or do you think we still haven't heard the whole story? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Well, we'll start first today in Washington with John Bresnahan, Capitol Hill Bureau Chief for Politico. John, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So we should note that we've arrived at a moment that's only happened two other times in United States history. This is the third time we've had a day like today. So what do we expect from this historic day?
Well, today will be housekeeping for the Senate in the sense that the House managers transmitted the articles of impeachment. They brought them to the Senate. They read the articles of impeachment out, and then the senators are sworn in by Chief Justice John Roberts. He's sworn all 100 senators today.
Mm. Now, just briefly, I want to get your take, John, on who Nancy Pelosi, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, named as the impeachment managers. What kind of message is she sending by the folks that she named?
Well, some of them were going to be managers no matter what. Jerry Nadler, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, he would have been manager in the 1999 Clinton trial. The then manager, Robert Sensenbrenner of the, James Sensenbrenner of the Judiciary Committee, was also manager. But he also named a couple others that were surprises. Well, Adam Schiff, the House Intelligence Committee chairman, he'll be the lead manager. He was the lead investigator for the House during the impeachment proceedings, and he will be a former federal prosecutor. He will be the voice of House Democrats during most of this trial. Zoe Lofgren, another senior member of the House Judiciary Committee, this is actually her third impeachment. She worked on the Nixon impeachment. She was part of the Judiciary Committee during the Clinton impeachment and now, of course, President Trump impeachment. And then a couple other members that are junior members, Val Demings, Jason Crow. These are kind of junior members, Celia Garcia of Texas, and then Hakeem Jeffries of New York. It's a very interesting mix. It's across the Democratic caucus. You know, Demings is not even a lawyer. She's a former law enforcement officer who's elected to Congress and serves on Judiciary Committee. Very impressive person. But it's interesting. It reflects the diversity, geographical and ethnic diversity inside the Democratic caucus. And this is the message that Pelosi's saying, that my entire caucus, this is how they feel. This is that, you know, all our members feel very strongly about the case against the president.
Mm. Now, if I understand this correctly, according to the rules of the Senate, once Chief Justice Roberts is sworn in as presiding over this trial, a summons will be issued to the president. He's going to have the opportunity to address the charges laid out in the articles of impeachment. Does that mean that we are pretty much guaranteed a start to this trial of early next week? That's what seems to be in the air.
Yes. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, the top Republican, top Democrat, they've already agreed that the trial will start next week. What they have to do, though, is work out the ground rules for the trial. And this is a huge issue. Right now, McConnell says he has 53 Republican votes to start the trial under the same process used in the Clinton impeachment trial. So there will be a presentation of the case by the House. The president will make his defense through his defense team, through his lawyers. And then there will be questions and answers by the senators. And at that point will be the huge issue of whether or not the Senate will vote on whether or not there will be additional witnesses. Now, during the impeachment trial, it's only a majority vote. It's only 51 senators get to decide. So if Republicans stick together, they can dictate the terms of this trial. But there are a number of moderate Republicans who are troubled by what they've heard since the House voted on impeachment on December 18th, including the Parnas evidence. So they're, you know, Susan Collins of Maine, Mitt Romney of Utah, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, so and possibly others. If they can get four Republican votes, Democrats can force additional witnesses, and that can lengthen the time of this trial.
Wow. Well, we're going to dig into that Parnas evidence in just a couple of minutes here. But, John, just so there's so many names, it's kind of hard to keep it straight sometimes. But if I remember correctly, I mean, the witness question is so vitally important because even people like John Bolton, right, have said that if he is summoned to the Senate trial, that he would testify.
It's that he has said, if the Senate subpoenas me, I will testify. Now, that's not clear if that he'll actually be able to do it. President Trump will raise legal claim to executive privilege that could block Bolton from testifying. But there's also other officials, Michael Duffy of OMB, and there's other officials who are involved in this Ukraine scandal and the timing of withholding the money and spreading that information around to other agencies, including the Department of Defense. So it's not clear if Bolton would be able to testify by the time this Senate trial is finished, because Trump could raise an executive privilege claim, and that would have to go to federal court.
Mm. Well, last question for you, John. To the point that 100 U.S. senators will be raising their hands, or are raising their hands today, to say that they will oversee impartial justice in this trial, while at the same time we have the Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, he's already made it exquisitely clear that he's going to run this trial exactly how President Trump would want him to run it. Where's the impartiality?
That's a very good question. Listen, in 1999, Chuck Schumer, he was then in the House. He actually voted three times on impeachment. He voted in the House Judiciary Committee against Clinton's impeachment. He voted against it on the floor in the House. Then he was elected to the Senate and voted against it there. And he even said during his Senate campaign, look, a vote for me is a vote for, you know, acquittal of President Clinton. I mean, this is technically, they're not jurors. This was one of the issues that came up in 1999, even though they're called jurors. They're not jurors in the sense, and they are political figures. And you know, McConnell has addressed this, and he was asked about this the other day, and he said, look, senators bring to this proceedings their own experience and their own, you know, role in the government. They are elected officials, and they are, you know, I mean, impeachment is the ultimate partisanship. It is shirts and skins. It's your guys versus my guys. So, and it's a very, very difficult situation for them to pretend they're impartial when they have so much at stake. I mean, this battle for the Senate is up for grabs in November, and President Trump is at the top of the ticket. So, you know, This is what we see when we, you know, when there's an impeachment of a president during an election year, which has never occurred in U.S. history. So this is, you know, this is a very, very partisan moment, and it's going to, you know, they'll claim impartiality, but the reality is that there is not a lot of impartiality at this point. Mm.
Well, John Bresnahan, Capitol Hill bureau chief for Politico. John, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's go to a call really quickly. Kenny is calling from Plattsburgh, New York. Kenny, what do you think of this moment in American history?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm just kind of taken aback by the different kind of perceptions that it seems to be taken. Like, the whole impeachment process seems to be criminal to the Democrats. Like, Pelosi's chosen a whole bunch of litigators that know the law and what is and isn't proper and things like that. And while in the Senate, it looks like the Republicans are just kind of looking at this as a political stunt, something to, like, bolster the campaigns for the presidency coming up. And it just doesn't seem like they're taking it seriously. And I'm just wondering your thoughts about that.
Well, you know what? I'm not sure, Kenny, because what I'd like to do, and I appreciate your call, there's a lot of other things that have been happening in the past 48 hours that might help us sort of understand this moment a little bit better. So let's do that now. And Kenny, thanks so much for calling. Let's go to Miriam Elder. She's joining us from New York. She's senior political reporter for BuzzFeed News and a former Russia correspondent for The Guardian as well. Miriam, welcome to you.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for having me.
I didn't mean to just sort of completely avoid answering Kenny's question about like Democrats versus Republicans and how they're viewing the Senate trial. But I mean, I think that's something that I'd allow partisans and pundits to respond to. But what I'd love to explore with you is all the facts around what's been happening in the past 48 hours. OK, so these new revelations from Lev Parnas. First of all, remind us, who is he?
So Lev Parnas was born in the Soviet Union, emigrated to the U.S. Pretty young, and has a lot of knowledge of how things work in Ukraine. And so he became a sort of fixer for Rudy Giuliani as he carried out this this mission in Ukraine for the president. And he was also a donor to Donald Trump, and just tried to become like a political player in the U.S.
And he's been indicted, right?
Sure has.
On what?
He's been indicted on charges that aren't directly related to the impeachment inquiry, but it involves like campaign finance violations.
Okay. And what is he saying now?
So Lev Parnas really dominated the news cycle yesterday. He's come out swinging. Looks like he's just completely dropped any support for anybody in the Trump circle. And he started with an interview on Rachel Maddow. Then he talked to Anderson Cooper. He talked to The New York Times. And he's out there saying, look, the defense that the people around the president are making and that the president himself is making, which is I didn't know the details of what was going on, are completely false, that the president was entirely in the loop.
Well, we'll talk more about the details of what Parnas is saying and the impact it might, or who knows, might not have on the impeachment trial itself. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the latest in the impeachment of President Donald Trump and a whole trove of new information or allegations coming from an associate of Rudy Giuliani, this person named Lev Parnas. Now, on the Rachel Maddow show on MSNBC last night, Parnas made this explosive claim in this exchange with Maddow.
What do you think is the main inaccuracy or the main lie that's being told that you feel like you can correct?
That the president didn't know what was going on. President Trump knew exactly what was going on. He was aware of all of my movements. I wouldn't do anything without the consent of Rudy Giuliani or the president.
Lev Parnas last night on MSNBC. I'm joined today by Miriam Elder. She's senior political reporter for BuzzFeed News and a former Russia correspondent for The Guardian. Miriam, the president, he's saying that the president knew exactly what was going on, meaning what? What is he saying?
Meaning that he wasn't freelancing in any sense of the word, that he was carrying out a mission that was given to him by Rudy Giuliani. And because Rudy Giuliani is the personal lawyer to the president, his, as he understood it, the president was completely informed via Giuliani of everything that he was doing.
But the specific things like the disinformation campaign about Giuliani's targets, what are the things?
Well, I think that that's where the interesting question arises, because Parnas made a lot of explosive claims last night, but it's really important to find the receipts, as it were. And that's where this huge trove of information, the text messages between him and various players, voicemail notes, that's where it all comes into play. And that's where we can see kind of the details of what the president supposedly knew. Otherwise, a lot of it is, conjecture from Parnas, who we have to remember is not necessarily necessarily an entirely reliable witness.
Right. And we'll get to that in a second, because I imagine one of the immediate responses from the president and or his supporters would be along the lines of what they said regarding Michael Cohen, the president's former personal lawyer here. But I just want to dig in with you, Miriam, on the specific things that Parnas is saying, that, for example, the president knew, even though he didn't talk to him directly, about efforts to smear, for example, Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch.
Yeah, it's to smear Marie Yovanovitch and all the meetings that he was, Parnas says, all the meetings that he was holding on these visits to Ukraine with various Ukrainian officials, that, you know, Giuliani and by extension the president knew that these meetings were taking place and that he was trying both to convey this, like, negative message about Marie Yovanovitch and also to talk to people who potentially had damaging information on Joe Biden.
Okay. And to the point where, aren't there some, isn't there a text exchange that implies that, were they having people follow the ambassador around?
Yeah, this has become like a kind of confusing part of the whole thing. But it was one of the most explosive text message exchanges. And in it, Parnas is texting with this guy, Robert Hyde, in the Trump circle. And Hyde is out there saying, we know where the ambassador is. Oh, she talked to this person. Oh, she had a phone call. Oh, she's outside Kiev. And he says, Do you know, anything is possible in Ukraine. Do you need some guys to follow her? Parnas last night on Rachel Maddow said that he didn't take those claims seriously, that he kind of looked at Hyde as like basically a blowhard drunkard, to paraphrase him. But then today, you know, the Ukrainian government came out early this morning and said, we're going to investigate whether this surveillance of the U.S. ambassador was happening or not.
So now there is an official Ukrainian investigation going on, but maybe not the one the president wanted.
Exactly.
Okay. So one of the hallmarks of all this, all the new Ukraine news, it's just hard to sort of get a big picture sense as to really what's going on, because there's so many players and so many details and they keep coming fast and furious. But is the point here, Miriam, that we have this man, Lev Parnas, who is an associate of Rudy Giuliani, who's basically saying, he claims that 100% from the start, the president's decisions and actions regarding Ukraine were not for the purposes of rooting out corruption, but were exclusively for the purposes of investigating Joe Biden.
Yeah, I think that's the main takeaway. And on the one hand, yes, he says it, and he said it repeatedly yesterday in all these interviews that he gave. But that's also something that comes through in these materials that have been turned over to the impeachment inquiry. It really shows that there's this concerted campaign against the U.S. ambassador who Trump eventually recalled, and then that's something that this one Ukrainian political player wanted. And in exchange, he was offering basically dirt on Biden, who is Trump's political rival.
Okay. Well, during the impeachment investigations a little while ago, the president was pressed by reporters about his involvement with Giuliani's associates, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman. We'll talk about Fruman in just a second here, but here's what the president said about whether he knew these men.
What conversations have you had with Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman?
I don't know those gentlemen.
You're in pictures
with them.
Now,
it's possible I have a picture with them because I have a picture with everybody. I don't know them. I don't know about them. I don't know what they do. But I don't know. Maybe they were clients of Rudy. You'd have to ask Rudy. I just don't know.
Miriam Elder, the Lev Parnas has not yet said that he's directly been in contact with the president, right? So, I mean, is what the president's saying here plausible? He doesn't know them.
I mean, Parnas, that statement is what kicked off, Parnas version 2.0, where mm-hmm. he's just spilling everything that he knows. It angered him incredibly because, in his telling, the president was completely knowledgeable both about what he was doing, but also who he was. And there's, ever more photos coming out. Parnas was a big selfie taker. of him taking, you know, selfies and pictures with people in Trump's closest orbit, his family, associates. And in Parnas's telling, the president absolutely knew who he was.
Okay, so Miriam, hang on here because I want to bring into the conversation now Andrew Weiss. He joins us from Washington. He's vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he oversees research on Russia and Eurasia. He's also former director for Russian, Ukrainian and Eurasian affairs at the National Security Council, and he worked in the office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy during the administrations of President Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. So, Andrew Weiss, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here.
Put this in context. Do you believe that the allegations or revelations that Lev Parnas has been offering us all for the past day, are they significant in understanding what the president's intentions were regarding Ukraine?
Well, I think it's important to step back a little bit. And as you were saying, there's so many names and there's so many elements of this. And I'd just say there's probably three or four levels that people need to focus on. The first and immediate one was that in March of 2019, there was a presidential campaign in Ukraine. And the then president of Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, was in deep trouble. And the people around him, including some of these law enforcement figures who are really dubious characters, they're not Elliot Ness, they're something a lot more dodgy, were all worried about saving their skins. And they were trying to build whatever bridges they could to the White House and to European governments to basically find a way to get a Hail Mary set of reactions that would help them hang on to power. Zelensky swooped in and won the election overwhelmingly in April and was sworn in, I think, in the second half of May. And around that time, the Trump administration was also bracing for release of the Mueller report. And so part of what all of this, the genesis of, were focused on was an attempt to discredit the findings of what they were expecting in the Mueller report, which would be potentially very damaging about cooperation between members of the Trump team and the Russian effort to interfere in our 2016 presidential election. The third level of this was at some point, and it's not clear exactly why, Rudy Giuliani and other members of kind of the Trump orbit were starting to hear that, you know, and President Trump had amplified this himself as early as, I think, April of 2017 when it was at a press conference, that the real story here is not Russian interference, it's Ukrainian interference. And at that point, when Giuliani sort of gets the bit between his teeth that, yeah, I need to focus on that as a way of discrediting Mueller, various Ukrainian officials and hangers-on and wheeler-dealers, including the two gentlemen we've been talking about, are basically helping him get the goods on Ukraine so that he can say, yeah, this is a really serious thing. And the Biden issue is embedded within that, you know, that there's real corruption here. It needs to be looked at. And it's not clear to me. There's a very prominent Ukrainian figure named Dmytro Firtash, who's sort of one of the big heavies in the Ukrainian oligarchic structure, who starts, I think, both enlisting these two gentlemen, these two Ukrainian-American figures, but also sort of offering information that's too good to be true. And it's a way of sort of getting the Trump people to deal with what he's dealing with, which is a federal criminal prosecution in the state of Illinois. So there are all these different levels of agendas that are colliding. And the last one is the fact that Fruman and Parnas are sort of out to make a buck. Rudy Giuliani seems to be out to make a buck. And all of these agendas seem to push them deeper into the what is, I think, a very shadowy, confusing world of Ukrainian politics and collide with U.S. policy.
This is all culminating in an impeachment trial, which is starting next week, right? And I just wonder, given the various levels that you just went through, Andrew, do you think that what you described is impeachable and convictable behavior by a president of the United States?
I'm not a constitutional scholar, so I can't give you, and I'm not a politician, so I can't give you an answer. I can tell you that U.S. foreign policy was totally upended in this case by these agendas, both from Ukrainians and by members of the Trump team and by the president himself. So when the president basically goes into this mode of trying to shake down the new Ukrainian president and say, you can't get your defense aid, you can't get other support from the United States, you can't get a meeting with me, this is, I think, a total miscarriage of his responsibilities. At the end of the day, I'm just in dismay about the fact that the U.S.-Ukrainian relationship, which has been so central to that country's ability to deal with the results of Russian aggression in 2014 and the war in eastern Ukraine has been basically blown up by this set of, I think, really sort of bumbling political shenanigans and a sense that, you know, private agendas here overrode our national interest. And I think that's something that's happened in other parts of the world that's not singular to Ukraine. We know a lot more about the Ukraine example, but I think it's indicative of how this administration operates.
Miriam Elder, what do you think?
Whether it's an impeachable offense or not?
Yeah.
I'll plead similar to Andrew that I'm, you know, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I think if we're focusing here on abuse of power, some of the evidence that came out this week in particular, in addition to all the evidence that was spoken by the witnesses during the inquiry in the House, you know, it really undermines some of the president's main arguments. One of his biggest arguments has been that he's out there battling corruption in Ukraine, and that's, you know, involving supposedly an American citizen, and that's part of his job as president, and that everything that was happening from the policies that he was enacting to what Rudy Giuliani was doing was in service of the American people. And one of the things that came out in this evidence dump this week was a letter from Rudy Giuliani to President-elect Zelensky requesting a meeting. And in that, there's an amazing first paragraph where he just repeats himself over and over again saying, I am the personal lawyer of the president. This is totally normal. I am not a part of the U.S. government. I am personal, personal, personal. And that's him basically saying, what I am doing in personal service of Donald Trump, not the office of the U.S. president. And I'm sure that's something that will be heavily discussed next
right.
week.
Well, so Andrew, reflect on that, because while Mr. Giuliani may claim that he's the personal lawyer of the president, at the same time, one of the things for the past couple of months that we've been hearing, as you pointed out, I mean, we have career Foreign Service officers who testified in front of the House saying that this unofficial channel, quote unquote, unofficial channel, was acting in opposition to longstanding U.S.-Ukraine policy, right? And so, I mean, what are the long-term impacts of that?
I think it really pulls the Band-Aid off. And a lot of people inside the government and people outside the government have basically been taking some reassurance that, you know, there's this craziness at the very top. You have a president who says all sorts of things that sound like Russian talking points, who's chasing after Putin, who wants to, you know, get along with Russia and all that stuff. But that, you know, the people who are charged every day with our foreign policy and implementing it have been able to insulate their whatever issue is, in this case, Ukraine policy, from the craziness of the Trump White House and its, you know, broader entourage. I think it's abundantly clear from this case that that's a fallacy, that most U.S. policy is totally, at this point, I'd say, decorative or titular in nature. And the real policy is what Rudy Giuliani and you know, Ambassador Sondland and others were engaged in. Mm-hmm. The level of direct access to President Trump seems to confirm that they were able to, you know, snap their fingers and persuade and cajole the president to do things, or to get members of the senior leadership team at the White House to do things, including put a hold on our defense cooperation with Ukraine and treat it basically as a bargaining chit for what was, you know, clearly a domestic political goal, which is to, you know, put as much negative scrutiny of former Vice President Biden.
Well, you know, on that point, just today, we have the news that the Government Accountability Office has concluded that the White House violated the law by withholding that military aid, right? The GAO is concluding that withholding funds violated the Impoundment Control Act. But members of the White House and supporters of the president, Andrew, have been saying that you know, withholding funds is par for the course in terms of the enactment of American foreign policy.
Well, it's understandable. I mean, Donald Trump has always run a really small family business. It was a real estate firm, and then it was a TV and marketing firm. It was run out of, you know, basically a small group of people out of his hip pocket. Running the U.S. government's a totally different thing. There are all sorts of interests at stake. There are all sorts of institutional concerns. There's all sorts of historical concerns of what we are as a country and how we expect our elected representatives and the executive branch to push those priorities forward. In this case, it's been turned all on its head, and it's been, you know, Trump on a whim, acting on a hot tip from Rudy Giuliani of information presumably presented to Giuliani by one of the biggest oligarchs in Ukraine who wanted, you know, special favors. He wanted to get friends of the president to go in to see Attorney General Barr and try to fix his criminal liability in the state of Illinois. I mean, it's really preposterous when you unpack it that way.
Well, Andrew Weiss and Miriam Elder, stand by. We are talking about the latest in the impeachment of President Donald Trump and new revelations from Rudy Giuliani's associate Lev Parnas. Find us online on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And on Twitter, Michael Atkinson is saying, simple solution, new evidence, new articles of impeachment. We'll explore whether that's a possibility at all when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the latest in the impeachment of President Donald Trump and about new revelations from Rudy Giuliani's associate Lev Parnas about what allegedly the president's intentions were in Ukraine. I'm joined today by Andrew Weiss. He's vice president for studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he oversees research on Russia and Eurasia. And Miriam Elder is with us as well. She's senior political reporter for BuzzFeed News. And Miriam, let's just play another moment from Lev Parnas's multiple interviews yesterday and today. He was also on CNN last night speaking to Anderson Cooper.
The administration says, and Jim Jordan in Congress and a lot of the president's defenders in Congress say the president was deeply concerned about corruption in Ukraine.
Like I said, I'm not going to go into personal attacks on anybody here, but they all know. They go home at night. They all have a conscience. I've been there when they liked him, when they didn't like him, when they talk behind his back, when they agree with him and disagree with him. And to see the things that they're doing now and just blindly just, I mean, it's a sham. It's a shame.
Lev Parnas on CNN last night with Anderson Cooper. Miriam, when he says they all know, how big is this circle? How wide is this net expanding, this Parnas net?
Well, judging by the evidence that was released this week, it seems pretty big. One of the revelations was that he was texting with Tommy Hicks, who used to be involved with a pro-Trump super PAC, co-chair of the Republican Party now. And there's evidence of Parnas texting him all these stories that malign the former ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. Tommy Hicks responding, Parnas saying, oh, you should tweet this or you should retweet this. And Hicks responding, oh, I should keep my hands clean, which both shows how the messaging kind of works as this campaign against Yovanovitch built up, all these stories going back and forth and people trying to convince other people to take part in it on Twitter and on TV. And then also Hicks kind of acknowledging there that it was dirty. Why else would he have to keep his hands clean? And then a host of other names were coming out. But I think the broader point that it seems to me Parnas was making there was that the kind of the argument being made by the president's supporters that this was a president who was concerned about corruption and a president who was concerned about, you know, the future of Ukrainian democracy and U.S.-Ukraine relations, it's just clearly not the case. He's saying something that a lot of people have known for a long time.
Well, last night on MSNBC, Parnas specifically said that when he saw Representative Devin Nunes as a major Republican voice in the impeachment hearings, he said he was, quote, he was in shock when he was watching the hearings. And he saw Devin Nunes sitting up there. Parnas told Rachel Maddow, I texted my attorney. I said, I can't believe this is happening, because he says he claims to have met Nunes several times.
Right. And that's something that Nunes has denied. And Nunes has also, like, threatened to sue a bunch of news outlets that have reported on his or his staff's involvement in this Ukraine campaign. So it's, you know, Parnas is basically out there now kind of peeling back the layers and, again, providing the receipts and showing, you know, showing who's lying and who isn't.
Why is he doing this now?
This man, it seems to me, does not want to spend a lot of time in jail because of Rudy Giuliani. He is trying to save himself. He's trying to save himself in terms of prison time, potentially. I think he's trying to save his reputation. He aligned himself. It seems like he thinks now that he aligned himself with the wrong people and is truly trying to save himself. He says that it's also, you know, he's trying to be a patriot and he's serving his country. That might well be true. But the fact is he's also facing a very serious case here in New York, and he needs to save himself however he can.
This is exactly what Michael Cohen said, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, it's kind of like this is the Trump presidency in a nutshell. You know, he surrounds himself with people who will serve him loyally. And when they are found out or cast out, they turn on him. You know, like if Parnas no longer has the protection of Trump's circle, Trump's circle does not control the Southern District of New York. He needs to save himself otherwise.
Let's go to Anthony, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. Anthony, you're on the air.
Hi, Meg. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I mean, I've just got to say, appreciate that Lev Parnas came out with all this, you know, tell-all stuff, because it's pretty damning, it sounds like. And I was watching the MSNBC interview yesterday, and the two things I took from it was it sounded like he kind of implicated the vice president in this, because he was conditioning his attendance at the inauguration on all of this. And we all know it wasn't at, you know, the national security interests of the United States. It was at the Donald Trump interest. So that's number one, Vice President Mike Pence. And number two is that this guy, Mr. Hyde, he was trying to, like, seek bids on a hit on the ambassador. Now, that is crazy. That might not be directly tied to Trump, but it kind of just speaks to what kind of operation they were running.
Mm. Well, Anthony, thank you for your call. And Miriam, clarify something about what that last thought that Anthony left us with. I mean, hasn't Lev Parnas walked back from those, like, explosive allegations?
He has, and he said on Maddow last night that again, he didn't take this person seriously. But at the same time, they were texting over the span of days. I think it was a full week. So I agree with that caller that just the fact that such a level of, even if it's just rhetorical, aggression was being entertained by people involved in this Ukraine operation, that's incredibly disturbing.
Mm.
And the fact that the State Department, that the State Department and U.S. officials have really not commented on it at all, and it's kind of left to this new Ukrainian government to say, you know, this aggression will not stand.
Yeah. Well, Andrew Weiss, did you want to comment on that?
No, I think that catches it.
Okay. Well, let's go to Megan, who's calling from Weymouth, Massachusetts. Megan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if your guests could speak to if this is a different way for foreign entities, politicians or business people or whomever, to interfere with U.S. politics.
politics?
I just haven't heard anybody speak to that angle of it, and it feels like the news is all over the place. So,
Megan, I would agree with you on that. So, but do you mean U.S. politics and elections, or elections?
I mean both. I mean, you know, everyone's up in arms about interference in the elections, but what if you interfere by providing information that causes a U.S. president to be removed, or, you know, that's also a disruption involvement that I could see
That
being attempted or working, and therefore putting the U.S. government in.
Yeah. Okay.
Chaos of some kind.
Great. So, Megan, thank you so much for that question. Andrew Weiss, do you want to respond to her about does
sure thing.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
There are, I think, any number of indications both that foreign governments have been manipulating the Trump administration or trying to play to the pattern of self-dealing. There's also plenty of information based on this Ukraine inquiry that all of what Rudy Giuliani or Ambassador Sondland were trying to do, all of what they were trying to do, was conducted over open lines on cell phones directly with President Trump in at least one instance. And so any number of other countries, namely Russia, have been aware of this, if not involved in some form, trying to undermine U.S. foreign policy. There are also indications that the Justice Department and the intelligence community are seeing new possible evidence that Russians are working to amplify and undermine Vice President Biden's presidential campaign. There was an article on Friday, which a lot of people I don't think picked up on, where you have the head of the National Security Division of the Justice Department and a senior intelligence official saying that they expect the Russians to really ramp up their interference activities in the run-up to 2020. So there's a lot going on. And what's remarkable here is that you have what seems to be, you know, from president on down in his inner circle, a desire to cut Ukraine loose. And who benefits from that ultimately is Russia. And why Trump is doing things like this, why Trump seems to be so eager to cut Ukraine loose, is presented publicly as, well, he thinks they're all corrupt or they were working against his campaign in 2016. That's a very, I mean, it could be true, but, you know, the broader geopolitical implications of what he's doing are far bigger and far more serious, but particularly for our own national security. Mm.
Miriam, is there any possibility that the revelations in the news cycle for the past 2 days will make it into the impeachment trial slated to start next week?
I think it's such a politicized process. But as I understand it, yes, I mean, the impeachment managers are like, they'll use it to bolster their arguments. I guess it's a secondary question on whether it will have any effect. I have to imagine that these interviews that Parnas is giving and some of the inconsistencies he's pointed out, like you mentioned with Devin Nunes, for example, will have to catch the eye of some people. But, you know, this is going to a Republican-controlled Senate that, for the time being, is really in lockstep with the president and has made it its mission to support him.
Mm. Now, one more quick question about Parnas in particular that I want to ask you, Miriam, because we should have explored it more a little earlier. The fact that he's been indicted, does that not automatically raise some credibility issues around him right now? I mean, that the supporters of the president have been saying exactly that, just that. Like, even Rudy Giuliani is saying, like, you can't really trust him.
I mean, I think the fact that he's been indicted, yes, and also the fact, you know, that he was involved in this campaign to begin with, although he says he did it because he thought he was being a patriot and protecting the president. But that's why, you know, with all the questions that we've discussed today, I try to keep it away from what he is saying and point to the evidence that he has provided. These are real-time text messages. These are real-time notes. These are real-time voice messages. And they really speak for themselves. So that, to me, puts aside the question of his credibility, which we absolutely have to keep in mind and interrogate. But looking at the evidence, all these pieces of evidence really speak for themselves.
Right. There are receipts in this case. Mm-hmm. Okay. So Andrew Weiss, we've just got about 3 or 4 minutes left here, and I want to make a little turn for a moment, because when our producer Steph Katsonis was setting up this hour, you told him that really the big news in your world is what happened inside of Russia just yesterday. So what happened and why is it important?
Thanks for raising that, Magnet. So President Putin, in theory, was term limited out and was supposed to leave office in 2024, according to the Russian Constitution. And there's been this kind of paralysis and parlor game dominating Russian politics for the last several years, which is, you know, is there a successor? How's he going to hold on to power? And all of those kinds of questions, as they accumulated, have created so much uncertainty and also created the risk that Putin was becoming a lame duck. So yesterday what he did is he announced that he's going to change the constitution. He's going to basically allow new bodies to take shape. I won't spell out the arcane details here. And basically position himself to hold on to power indefinitely. So the metaphor, the comparison is to what President Xi Jinping of China did a couple years ago. And the set of ripple effects that creates are things that are still being digested in Russia. But I think it means we're looking at a whole new sort of landscape where we don't get the wishful thinking outcome, which is that Putin's going to retire and, you know, sort of write his memoirs or something, but stay very much in power as one of the longest serving heads of state on the world stage.
And so but why is he doing this now? Is it the hunger for power, as you seem to be hinting, or does Putin have to protect himself for some reason once he's no longer the Russian president?
I think it was the risk of becoming a lame duck that, you know, he was going to start, you know, basically people were starting to look past him to figure out should they be throwing their support to some of the people positioning to replace him. And in the end, you know, he's not someone that the world has ever had to deal with. We haven't had a Russian leader since the Stalin era who's been in power for 2 decades. And it's inconvenient to have someone now who's been in power that long who, frankly, looks down on most of the world leaders as people who are kind of Johnny's come lately and who don't know how we got to the position we're in. So in some ways, Putin is able to sort of sit back and wait for us to come to him and continue to dictate the terms of his relationship with the outside world. We remain very reactive, and Putin remains the person who's directing most of the very dangerous situation we're in.
Mm. So help me understand something else, though. And again, just the details really matter here. Putin's term was supposed to have ended in 2024. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. But in this whole process of what happened yesterday, did he made Medvedev step down as well?
So what he's done is he's appointed a very obscure Russian politician, the equivalent of their IRS, who was confirmed today by the Duma. He's kicked Medvedev upstairs and made him essentially the deputy head of their Security Council, which is basically a gathering or a Politburo type body, leaving Medvedev potentially down the road as another stand-in for him should he ever choose to leave power, because Medvedev is a trusted longtime associate. And then he's created a new body, which doesn't really have any power today, called the State Council. It's a little bit like saying he's going to be the postmaster of some random Russian province. Everyone knows that he is the guy and that he'll continue to dominate the political landscape for the foreseeable future.
Wow. Well, Andrew Weiss, Vice President for Studies at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he oversees research on Russia and Eurasia. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Miriam Elder, senior political reporter for BuzzFeed News. Miriam, thank you so much for walking us through all the new details of the past 48 hours. Thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thank you.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Dow, Mylene Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Carolyn Love and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.